you repeat yourself, the answer should be clear. How many times you've acted like you live without fear? My suggestion, your only attempt, and get right before you get left. You've been acting all innocent, saying you take offense. That lipstick on your white collar is all the evidence. My suggestion, your only attempt, and get right before you get left. Get right before you left. Best thing for yourself. Get right before you get left. The best thing for yourself. No use denying you'll only be lying. Get right before you get left.
Hi there, it's time for Stay Human, which means you gotta try to get right and dance a little bit while you do. On today's show, it's Bertolt Brecht in Big Fork. And we go to the gangster movies with Jack Nachbar and hear about some of the folks in your town sworn to protect the Constitution. Stay tuned before you get left.
You repeat yourself, answer sure is clear. How many times you've acted like you live without fear? My suggestion, your only attempt, you get right before you live. Get right before you get left. Best thing for yourself. Get right before you get left. Best thing for yourself. No use denying you'll only be lying. Get right before you get left. Go ahead and say no, put away all your sin. My suggestion, your only attempt, to get right before you live. Get right before you live. Best thing for yourself. Get right before you live. Best thing for yourself. Notice the man you'll only be alive. Get right before you live. Get right before you live. Best thing for yourself. Get right before you left. Best thing for yourself. No use the man you'll always be left. Get right before you left.
That's the Nick Moss Band. I'm Michael Goldberg. I've been thinking lately about being complacent. You know, my baseline assumption that whatever bad things are happening or might happen, I'm okay. It's not happening to me. My complacency took a major shock in November 2016. I know, I'm not the only one. But that was a whole year and a half ago. And old habits die hard. And it worries me to think that at some point, complacency about evil doing, about people being treated badly, at some point that complacency becomes complicity. I was getting my hair cut by a barber I'd never been to. Fox News was on the TV in the shop, and a story about immigration led him to comment that people should just stick to their own, it's only natural. I asked him to explain what he meant, and he offered a metaphor of a room. Imagine a room, he said, getting more and more crowded with people from all over, different places, different backgrounds, different ways of acting. You know it's bound to lead to trouble, he says. Well, what if that room was this barbershop, I asked him. Are you saying I shouldn't bring my mixed-race grandson in here for a haircut? Or I shouldn't be here because I'm Jewish and most of your customers aren't? There was a pause, and then a long, long pause, and finally I realized it wasn't a pause. He wasn't going to say anything at all. Pretty much finished the haircut in silence. I go to a different barbershop now just to be on the safe side. I had noticed that there was a plaque on the wall for Oath Keepers, pro-life, pro-God, pro-gun. The window sticker version of this includes little graphics for each, heart for pro-life, cross for pro-God, gun for pro-gun. I asked him about Oath Keepers, and he said, "We defend the Second Amendment and the rest of the Constitution, too." When the Oath Keepers say, "defend the Constitution," they don't just mean write editorials about it. They mean lock and load for patriotic missions. In the days leading up to the 2016 elections, the Oath Keepers showed up at polling places to, quote, ensure the election is not stolen from the American people. Instructed to leave their guns at home for this mission unless they had a concealed carry permit, they were told, go out into public on election day, dressed to blend in with the public. With video, still camera, and notepad in hand, look for and document suspected criminal vote fraud or intimidation activities. More recently, they've called on members to post armed guards outside schools. Notify the school of your intent, the leader, Stuart Rhodes, says to his followers, and then goes on to say, notice the key word there is notify rather than ask for permission. Also this year, the Oath Keepers have joined up with the Minutemen to help secure the southern U.S. border with heavily armed operatives instructed to observe and report only, no confrontations unless someone confronts you. Here's former California State Assemblyman Tim Donnelly, currently running for U.S. Congress, explaining the mission on the California side of the Mexican border.
When the political leaders who are supposed to follow the dictates of our founding documents, which says that the reason we organize governments and the reason that governments are here among men is to protect our natural and inalienable rights, that of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. When Jerry Moonbeam Brown, I can't even call him governor anymore, says I'm going to make this state a sanctuary for criminal illegal aliens, then he has essentially become a threat to Americans. He has decided to turn our neighborhoods into cesspools and leave us to defend for ourselves, while at the very same time stripping away our Second Amendment and stripping away our First Amendment. All of those things are under assault. That is why we are here today.
The thing that gets me about this, that scares me really, is that the Oath Keepers are recruited from active duty or retired military and police, and sheriff's departments, and emergency first responders, people who are trained and willing to put their lives on the line. There's an active group in Itasca County. You might see them at the county fair this summer. They'll be right next to the sheriff's station on the fairgrounds in uniform. These are guys who are not decompressing, a friend of mine told me. He has decades of experience in military combat, a specialist in PSYOPs, and he's worked with hundreds of other vets as a veterans advocate. Decompressing? Yeah, he says. These are guys, many of them, who have been repeatedly concussed or faced dangerous, awful situations over and over. The work is traumatizing, and if you don't decompress, flush the poisons, talk it out, then the next trauma adds to the burden and leads to aberrant behavior of all kinds, including violence. Really, I look at it as a cry for help. I appreciated him telling me this, getting me to think of these people as individuals instead of dehumanizing them the way their ideology dehumanizes others. A cry for help. Or, if you don't decompress, maybe what you do is you find other guys who are in the same boat as you, and then you bolster each other up and you plan your next mission. Still, our local sheriff's deputies? I don't think I should be complacent, but I also don't want to be overly alarmist about it. So I asked Brian Vroman, who teaches history at Itasca Community College, what he makes of the Oath Keepers.
Well, I don't want to be overly alarmist either, but for me, red flags go off. One of the major problems in Germany after World War I was the rise of essentially private militias. It wasn't only the Nazis with the SA and then later the SS, but all kinds of political parties had their own paramilitary forces, and there was violence in the streets. I think that that's something, you know, the idea of a group of armed men, that's something the state should have a monopoly on. I don't think that the thing to do is just to go out and form your own group in order to further your agenda. There are processes that are in place for doing this sort of thing. And the idea that some group of people should just go form a militia is, I think it's just a major danger to law and order and to our freedom. After World War I, there were all kinds of veterans of the German army who had real difficulty readjusting to civilian life. And even though the war was horrible, you know, imagine, you know, 4 years in the trenches if you survived the whole thing, some of them missed the camaraderie of being in the army. They missed that sort of thing, and so they tried to recreate that. And so the Nazis had the SA, but there were other... there were various other, mostly on the right, there were various other paramilitary organizations. And eventually, when Hitler was very close to rising to power, they supported the Nazis as well. But Hitler had 1 million men in the SA at one point. And these are essentially armed thugs that went around and beat people up. The communists were on the left. They were causing problems too. And there were street battles between the SA and the communists. But this was mostly a right wing sort of thing. And that's mostly what it was. It was disgruntled veterans who were unable to, for whatever reason, to readjust to civilian life. And so they were trying to recreate that camaraderie that they felt in the service. I don't think Hitler would have come to power without the Great Depression. But I think we have to back up a little bit, because I don't think it was really about economics primarily. When the German army was defeated, the German public was shocked. Because the German government had a very good propaganda organization that propagandized and lied to its own people. And the German citizens thought the whole time that they were winning the war. And then suddenly they hear that the army has surrendered. Well, what? What happened here? And so there emerges what can be called the big lie in German history. The lie that somehow the army, it wasn't defeated, it was stabbed in the back. Well, who did it? Well, communists did it. There was a Bolshevik revolution in Russia. There are communists here, maybe, you know, conspiracies again, who stabbed us in the back. Democrats did it. Germany wasn't really a democratic society. It had some democratic institutions, but it was still very authoritarian with the power in the hands of the Kaiser. So people who wanted a more democratic government, it was them. It was the liberals, right, using today's lexicon. But most of all, it was the Jews. And that was the dangerous one, because that's the one that Hitler and others picked up on. And this is, obviously, it's a tragedy, but it has no basis at all in reality. There were Jews who served in the German army. They thought of themselves as German. You know, they were enculturated. There were Jews who won the Iron Cross, the highest German medal for valor. But yet this conspiracy grows that the German army was stabbed in the back by Jews and others. And I think that's maybe relevant today, because we do have some problems in society today, and there's a temptation to blame it on other people. It's the immigrants, it's the Muslims, or whomever. The Nazis attacked the press too. They called it the lying press, sometimes the lying Jewish press. And before Hitler came to power, there were lots of German newspapers, but only 3% were controlled by the Nazis. But of course, once he took control, they shut down all the other newspapers and news outlets in general, radio and otherwise, and they took them over. Sometimes they would use holding companies to disguise the true ownership, but they're all under Nazi control. But the first thing they did, that's I think that raises red flags today, is this overarching attack on the press. It's always the lying press. The media is a crucial institution in a free society. If we lose the free press, what then? We don't know what's going on then. Who's going to tell us what's going on? The government? But this is all based on fear. Hitler is also, he was able again to gin up fear of a conspiracy. You know, and it makes me think on a smaller scale of the Patriot Act after 9/11. Same sort of thing. There are evil, sinister people. We have to protect ourselves from them. And in order to do that, we need to give up our liberties.
Thanks to Brian Vroman, teaching history at Itasca Community College. Coming up, we'll hear about the allegory written in 1941 when Bertolt Brecht was in exile from Germany. That's being performed in Big Fork in a few weeks at the Edge Theater. First, here's the latest word from Femi Kuti in Nigeria.
Them still they manipulate the goal. These master coup
leaders, fathers of corruption, we dey watch their show. As them refuse to enter barracks, we be their house. Legislators, military men as governors, the militants, democracy.
That's a new release from Femi Kuti on Stay Human. This and many other local programs on Northern Community Radio receive support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, which is sales tax money that's used for the Minnesota Legacy Funds, preserving our natural and cultural legacies. That's part of the reason we have such a thriving local art scene throughout urban and rural Minnesota. Even though the Edge Center for the Arts is wildly unexpected, I never guessed they would bring the work of Bertolt Brecht to the community theater there. Brecht was a socialist playwright and poet in Weimar, Germany, a committed propagandist who escaped Nazi Germany, briefly found a home in Hollywood after the war, was blackballed and interrogated by the House Un-American Activities Committee. His theater of alienation, as he called it, was deeply unsettling, intentionally, and subversive. Here's Tom Waits' version of a piece written by Brecht with the music of Kurt Weill for the 1928 premiere of The Threepenny Opera.
Gentlemen who think you have a mission to purge us of the seven deadly sins should first sort out the basic food position, then start your preaching. That's where it begins. Your lot who preach restraint and watch your waist as well should learn for once the way the world is run. However much you twist, or whatever lies that you tell, food is the first thing, morals follow on. So first make sure that those who are now starving get proper helpings when we all start carving. What keeps mankind alive? What keeps mankind alive? The fact that billions are daily tortured, stifled, punished, silenced, and oppressed.
Yeah. From The Threepenny Opera by Bertolt Brecht. Brecht's 1941 play, The Resistible Rise of Umberto Uy, is an allegory of Hitler's rise to power set in gangland Chicago. I'm told it's in performance all the time lately somewhere in the world, Australia, Paris, London, college and community theaters. And it's going to be performed by the Edge Theater in Big Fork Thursday, June 21st through Sunday, June 24th. It's a big production for a community theater with 18 actors, many of them in terrific 1930s style hats, and then even more folks working on it behind the scenes. Last week, I visited with the founder of the Edge and director of this production, Patricia Feld. I asked her what made her decide to stage The Resistible Rise of Umberto Uy.
I decided to do the play because I really had a moment last fall, September, when the neo-Nazis decided to march through Charlottesville, Virginia, with their tiki torches saying, "The Jews will not replace us." This was in America, this was happening, and I'm Jewish, and it just stopped me cold. It was riveting to me. And, I mean, I knew there's always been sort of a latent anti-Semitism around places, but people know it's not fashionable to talk that way. But here were a whole bunch of people marching in the streets, and I was really shaken to my roots. And the best thing that I can do is I do theater, and I was looking for a piece of theater that was good theater that I could put my heart behind and produce in Big Fork. And that really was the basis. And then I looked for a play for a really long time. And life, like life usually is, I was in Northfield, Minnesota, and walked by Carlton. And they had just done a production of The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy. And I slapped my forehead absolutely as stereotypically as a person can do and said, "Of course, that's it. That's it." I had seen the production that the Guthrie did back in Gulp, 1968, and it really made an impression on me. It was written in 1941, and the first English translation was the one we're doing by Taburi in 1956. It's so much fun. Brecht called it a gangster spectacle. And I was not happy with the word spectacle, although it probably is going to be. I'm calling it a gangster comedy. So it's a little chump from New York. He's a small-time hoodlum, and he comes to Chicago because he's going to take over the Cauliflower Trust. He's going to sell protection to the grocers in Chicago. So he starts by doing all the things that gangland guys do. They threaten, they cajole, they sink a guy into some blackmail, and then they blackmail him, and then they get other guys on their sides, and then that pretty soon there's physical threats, and then there's arson, and then there's murder. And so he rises to the top of the Cauliflower Trust, and at the end he really wants to move on. He's going to take over Cicero. By the end of the show, he has risen, and I mean literally, he's up on a 7-foot-high lectern in the air, and he's going to take over the world. They're funny, and I'm doing it absolutely no-holds-barred acting style. It is as broad and face the audience, and instead of and a shocked reaction isn't wide eyes and a hand to the mouth. I mean, it's two steps back and your arms in the air, and it's very broad and it's very funny. And then, of course, it's super funny until it's not. And in between each of the scenes of the comedy, the Chicago gangster comedy, two of the actors come out with a beautiful hand-painted sign that tells the audience about what happened in Germany that the last scene that they just watched reflected. So, see a funny scene, somebody's warehouse burns down. On comes a sign that says, the Reichstag Parliament building burned down in da 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 da. And so it's a little lesson. Brecht always wanted a little lesson all the time. So, a person putting on a gangster comedy has to treat those little history lessons very carefully. So it isn't, ha, 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 oh boy, here comes a boring sign again. So each of my pairs of actors comes on stage doing something funny. I have a little pit orchestra, and the actors may be doing the soft shoe while they carry this sign. They might be having a fight between the two of them. So I'm lightening the historical, this is what really happened in the 30s. I'm lightening that so that the audience is frequently caught in a really nice cognitive dissonance. I'm laughing. Oh, wait a minute. I'm laughing at what just happened. The play's called The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy. It's not just called The Rise of Arturo Uy. And Resistible is really interesting from an actor and director point of view. What does it mean? So I have very assiduously asked just about every scene in the play. There are 16 and 18 actors. Where in this scene could someone have resisted? Could they have turned down the fraudulent stock deal? Could they have turned down the threat? Could they have banded together against Uwe and his thugs? Could they have not looked the other way because it was better for business? And if you watched the play with that in mind, or even in the back of your mind, you see how sure they could have. And yeah, it would have been hard in a lot of places. Yeah, one of our grocers says, I couldn't do anything. He has the Tommy guns. I only sell cauliflower. So is he complicit? Is he innocent? Boy, it goes on. It goes on throughout the play. It's not the irresistible rise of Arturo Uwe. People could have done something about him, and that was their choice not to. You think about complicity in big ways. Am I innocent because of the way our black brothers and sisters and LGBTQ brothers and sisters and immigrants and all the people who think differently than I do? I mean, am I complicit because I'm not doing something exactly for them? You know, the Jews have a phrase, tikkun olam, which means to heal the world. And I think that I've come to a place where if I can be doing something, I'm not going to beat myself up with a truncheon because I'm not doing everything.
That's Patricia Feld, director of the play at the Edge Theater, June 21st to the 24th. While I had her in Northern Community Radio's studios, I asked her to read me the final lines of the play.
At the end of the play, Arturo Uwe has risen to the heights, never risen in our theater physically ever, and he's going to take over the world. And then the curtain closes. I'm assuming there will be applause. But part of the play is that the actor who plays Uwe comes out as himself. And he peels off this little Hitler mustache that he's been wearing through the whole show. And he just sits down on the edge of the stage. And he does this 10-line epilogue. The lead actor, just one person to another person. If we could learn to see instead of gawking, we'd see the horror in the heart of farce. If we could act instead of talking, we wouldn't always end up on our arse. This bastard nearly had us mastered. Don't yet rejoice in his defeat, you men. Although the world stood up and stopped the bastard, the bitch that bore him is in heat again.
I seen my sister down on the street. She got blisters burning. Looking for a hit down in the gutter.
Trust yourself.
a gun in their hand. No, no, no. If you do what you're told, you better watch the tell. Before you believe, you got to see what they're selling. Don't give up your soul to nobody else.
That's the Akron family, and So It Goes. Which reminds me, I want to put Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse 5 on my reread it sometime list. So It Goes. Actually, there are too many books on the first time list, and another long list of books I know I'll never get to, including the whole subgenre that's been on the bestseller list lately on tyranny, how democracies die, Madeleine Albright's new book, Fascism, A Warning. I'll probably just wait till the movie comes out. One of the actors in that upcoming production at The Edge is our professor of pop culture, Jack Nachbar. The play got him thinking about one genre of popular American movies.
Gangster movies are as old as the flickers themselves. In 1900, the earliest moviegoers watched a picture entitled How They Rob Men in Chicago. The real heyday of mob movies, however, was the early 1930s, when more than 50 gangster movies splattered the screen with a rattle of Tommy guns, squealing tires, and dynamited storefronts. Prohibition, or rather violations of the 18th Amendment, was a main reason for the explosion of gangster movies from 1930 to 1934. People loved their illegal booze. There were 46,000 speakeasies in Illinois in 1932, and it is estimated that 85% of the adult population drank. It's no wonder that folks love the movies that featured the men who supplied this national thirst. The most popular gangster pictures were all about running liquor and beer. Caesar Rico in Little Caesar in 1931, Tom Powers in Public Enemy 1931, and Tony Camonte in Scarface in 1932 all rise to the top of their mob by grabbing control over the local hooch market. Some writers have identified a deeper reason for the early 30s popularity of mob movies. The mobster main character was a hero for the down-and-out American of the Depression. By 1930, 25% of working America was jobless, with no prospect of things getting better. The Herbert Hoover administration seemed helpless. Gangster heroes represented a radical alternative to a society which offered only despair. These were short men like Edward G. Robinson and James Cagney, who rose up to be big men of success. The American dream, but instead of doing it by the rules, the mobster rose in the world, violating all social and ethical norms. 30s gangsters relied on a radical, amoral individualism whose key to success was violent, murderous power. The rules of law were useless in this world. What was useful was a quick gun. Rico and Little Caesar disobeys the orders of the big boy, but eventually takes over the North Side and plans to rub out the big boy himself. Camonte in Scarface, entranced by a blinking sign outside his apartment that says, "The world is yours," uses Tommy guns to snuff out his superiors until he finally becomes boss of the city. At the same time, in Europe, other gang leaders were rising to the top. Fascism was in flower. Benito Mussolini, already a dictator for a decade in Italy, published his philosophy of power, Doctrine of Fascism, in 1932. In January 1933, Adolf Hitler's violent Nazi brown shirts and a group of right-wing businessmen forced President Hindenburg to appoint Hitler Chancellor of Germany. Back in the USA, fascism was also rearing its ugly head. By 1935, Senator Huey Long had abandoned FDR and was planning his own run for president. He had his own gang, the Share the Wealth Club, and upwards of 25 million radio listeners. His pal, Father Charles Coughlin, ranted right-wing theories to as many as 30 million radio listeners a week throughout the 30s. In 1934, he endorsed the fascist regimes in Europe. Coughlin also endorsed the infamous anti-Semitic lie, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a book which claimed, a la Hitler, a plan by Jews to take over the world. Fascism is the dark impulse in the modern human soul. It crawls out of its hole when there is deep anger over what appears to be the failure of society or government to address real problems. The gangster movies of the early 1930s suggest just how attractive fascism is to a frustrated populace. By featuring main characters like Rico and Tom Powers, growing to power with a monumentally ego, manic energy, and violent methods, the films reflected an international reactionary political trend, and not just on the screen. On July 22, 1934, on a hot night in Chicago, the famous gangster John Dillinger decided to go to an air-conditioned movie theater, the Biograph. It was showing a movie Dillinger would have loved, Manhattan Melodrama, a gangster movie. As he left the theater, Dillinger was gunned down by federal agents. People on the street rushed to the scene and dipped their handkerchiefs into the pool of blood beside the body. To them, Dillinger's blood was obviously a saintly relic, and his dangerous rush toward death was something to be admired and venerated. The popularity of these movies and audience identification with murderous main characters like Rico Powers and Kamade show just how attractive the fascistic impulse was during a dangerous low point in American life.
That's Jack Nachbar, our professor of pop culture and a frequent contributor to our program Stay Human, broadcasting every week on KAXE KBXE with the support of our listener members. Everything I know about organized crime, well, except for my cousin Arthur, who was a bagman for the Colombians until he got caught and turned state evidence against his own brother-in-law, among others. Copped a plea, entered the witness protection program, moved to Arizona. Of course, once the feds had him on the hook, they dangled him as bait whenever they wanted. But except for Arthur, all I know about organized crime is what I've seen in movies and TV. And if you were to stop and take count, an inventory of just the last 10 years, you'd realize it's everywhere, these stories of organized crime, way beyond the gangster movies of the 30s. But it's still the same story. As Edward G. Robinson says in one of my favorites, Bullets or Ballots, whenever mugs get into a jam, the first thing they do is start knocking each other.
You started this racket. You ought to have a share in it.
I suppose Mr. Blake will let me have it.
He'll have nothing to say about it. I'm running things from now on. If you want the Bronx and Harlem districts, they're yours. If you need protection, you'll get it. You don't trust me.
I don't trust anybody.
It's always the same story, and though the plot lines vary slightly of ruthless protection rackets and criminals versus the law, the actual drama mostly comes from the internal battles for power among the gangsters and within the crime family. I don't trust nobody is the key to survival. I was struck by this passage in James Comey's book, A Higher Loyalty, in which he says that meetings with President Trump reminded him of dealing with the mob bosses that he had pursued and prosecuted for years. He said, "The silent circle of assent, the boss in complete control, the loyalty oaths, the us versus them worldview, the lying about all things large and small, in service to some code of loyalty that put the organization above morality and above the truth." He kind of sounds just like a straight arrow G-man, doesn't he? You still see those types in some of the gangster shows, but mostly the feds are either themselves deeply morally compromised or, more often, overconfident stooges for the wily bad guys to outwit again. I've watched a lot of these shows, but the one I keep remembering is The Sopranos. It seems to stay relevant almost 20 years after it kicked off the new golden age of television at the turn of the century. Two things that I learned from that 86-hour-long saga that helped me see the world more clearly. One is the pain, the inner spiritual nightmare of the morally depraved, the cost of doing evil. Tony Soprano, and nearly everyone around him, has to be so walled off from themselves and from each other. They have to maintain such an elaborate structure of self-delusion and deception that when they're not reaping the spoils of their evil deeds, and sometimes even when they are, they live in a palace of dead souls. They're way at the end of a spectrum that I think includes all of us. I'm not sure about this. I suppose there must be saints at the other end, but mostly it's a matter of what it costs anybody, any of us, who lies and misuses people, who trusts and should be trusted by no one. And the other theme from The Sopranos that makes it seem so relevant to me is appetite, unrestrained, insatiable. Tony Soprano gained quite a bit of weight over the years that he reigned, and not just on Carmela's and Arthur's cooking. Appetite unlimited is why the American gangster story is so often a critique of capitalism, either with the populist hero facing down the real criminals who steal with a pen and kill at a distance, or, as in The Sopranos, as an allegory for greed and economic dominance. I don't know if gangster stories are more popular than they used to be, less popular, if they'll ever go out of style, but I'm pretty sure that psychopaths and oligarchs are always going to be around, that Tony Soprano is always going to be looking for the main chance.
Yeah.
That's Living Color with The Cult of Personality. I'm Michael Goldberg with Stay Human. Thanks to Jack Nachbar, Patty Feld, and Brian Vroman for being part of today's show. I hope you can join me this time next week. More words and more music for spirit and courage.
Thank you.